Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. My guest today is Denny Rancourt. Denny is special to me because of the travail that he's gone through for so long, and we've discussed it a number of times on this program, a distinguished world figure in his field, really in two fields, in physics, environmental science. His students at Ottawa University loved him. They absolutely loved him. He had a marvelous pedagogical technique. He focused on, if you can imagine, learning. Teaching is all about learning. If learning doesn't happen from the classroom, what's the point of teaching? And he was wrongfully accused of doing things that never happened. He was accused, really, I mean, this never really came up, I don't believe, not directly, maybe indirectly, but the real offense that he committed, quote-unquote offense, was supporting the rights of Palestinian people. And Denny, like myself and others on the right side of history, support the legal rights of everyone. No one's any better than anybody else. Nobody gets preference. Nobody gets denied. Everybody should be denied equally. But that's not the way the University of Ottawa sees things. Well, its fascist president makes the rules, and he decides, and Denny was banished. As far as I'm concerned, lawlessly, still trying to connect with Denny. His line has been busy. Going into voicemail, we'll keep trying to get him. When he comes on, we'll discuss the latest on his situation. I think at this point, because of what he's gone through in courtrooms, I think he's now an expert in three fields. He wasn't educated to be a lawyer, but I think he could very well. He's been defending himself admirably, and I think he can defend somebody else admirably at this point. He's taught himself what he needs to know, and he stood up admirably against very dark forces against him, including one of Canada's most powerful law firms connected to the power structure, and you know the way those cases usually go, including judges that usually go the wrong way against a legitimate plaintiff and for the wrong side. But this is what Denny has been fighting, and he's doing it with no funds. He's dependent on any kind of contributions anybody can make for him to pay his legal expenses, to print up the things that you need to bring in courtrooms. I don't know the names of all these documents, but you need special papers, you need this and that, you need them in so many copies, and these are very expensive to put together. And Denny literally exhausted all of his financial resources going through all of this. He doesn't pay a lawyer because he's his own lawyer. He can't afford a lawyer, but to spend all this money that he needs to come up with to produce all of these documents for multiple rounds of courtroom appearances, and I don't know the next one that's coming up, but this is what he's up against. And Denny really has thanked in the past, and he wants to thank listeners who have supported him. Anybody can find out how to do it by going to one of his two websites. I think one of them is, if you just Google Denny's name, D-E-N-I-S, Rancourt, R-A-N-C-O-U-R-T, when you pronounce it, the T is silent and the S is silent. And I think if you Google his name, I think one of them is activist professor. But if you Google his name, which is the way I find Denny's websites, you can go right to the site. You can see how you can support him with anything that he gets is very helpful. And listeners have supported him up to now, and Denny is supremely grateful. So we'll talk about his situation as soon as we connect with him. So much else is going on that keeps me active all the time. I had my first interview just a short time ago, about an hour ago, on Malaysian flight MH370. Well, it's not a topic I've written about. I read about so many, but I haven't written about that. And what I focused on in my discussion, it was a very brief interview on Press TV on a program they call The Top Five, and they featured five topics in a 30-minute program with a setup and so on and time for the end. So there's really a small amount of time devoted to each topic. And we discussed this, and I have another interview on a Safar TV program in Tehran tomorrow, very early tomorrow, discussing the same issue. I'll get about 20 minutes to discuss it, so I'll have more time. But the thing that concerns me most about this plane, on the one hand, it seems literally impossible that in an age of modern technology, a Boeing 777, if it only had the crew on board, never mind 239 passengers, would suddenly get lost The plane would get lost. The passengers would disappear. Nobody would know where they are. You've got multiple countries searching, China, Japan, Malaysia, Australia, Thailand, I believe, Vietnam, I believe, some Western countries, I think, America. You mean to tell me with satellites and all the other modern stuff, and this has been going on for 3 weeks, and there's no trace of this plane? Every time they think they find something in the ocean, there are always scraps of this and that floating around in the ocean. They turn out to be unrelated to this. Do you mean to tell me all of the modern technology available can't detect the wreckage of a plane if it crashed and if it disappeared someplace? Do you mean nobody has a clue where it might have been, what happened to any of these people? We do know that most of the passengers were Chinese. I don't know who they were. Were they Chinese officials? People that maybe somebody wanted to do ill to? So we don't know. Did the plane crash? Did it malfunction? Was it shot down? Was it a CIA operation? Were the people on board, or some of them, were they targeted for elimination? Does Washington know more than it's saying? There was a cryptic comment in the Financial Times, a statement I don't have in front of me at the moment, but the end of it said everything, basically everything that could be done was done, and the final two-word comment was, well done. Very cryptic. Well done what? A thorough search? Or well done getting rid of people that the powers that be wanted eliminated? The Financial Times contributor didn't say. There were other cryptic comments in other major media stories, but we don't know the answer to it. But what obsesses me most, more than anything else, is the way this story, especially on television, literally blocks out things that are vitally important. They either get short shrift, they get totally ignored, or when they're reported, big lies substitute for truth. My God, there are so many of these things. The Ukraine situation, the war in Syria, the Israeli-Palestinian situation, including the sham peace talks, completely one-sided, everything for Israel, nothing for Palestinians. That's the way these talks have always gone on. Not a word, nothing. On TV, you hear nothing reported about this stuff. Ukraine certainly gets some coverage, but it's all big lies. Truth is systematically blocked out, buried. And it's not the lead story. This missing airliner is the lead story. Well, my heart goes out to the families of these 239 people. For them, it's the lead story, without question. But for the rest of the world, how about the people being murdered in Syria every day? How about the Palestinians, Israelis are murdering? I put out an article yesterday about Israeli soldiers shooting Palestinian children in the back, doing nothing, shooting them in the back, murdering them in cold blood and getting away with it. How about a story featuring that? How about that for a headline? And it's not a one-time event. This goes on over and over again. How about Gaza being the world's largest open-air prison? How about slow-motion genocide taking place there since mid-2006, especially since mid-2007? How about the legitimately elected Palestinian government, legitimately elected in January 2006, democratically elected, overwhelmingly blocked out, denied, locked into Gaza illegitimately, denied their right to govern, and Israel, with members of the organization Hamas, who live in the West Bank, including their legislators, have been arrested and imprisoned. Why? For belonging to the wrong political party. How about a story on Israel explaining this? How about explaining its war of aggression on Lebanon in 2006? How about explaining its gas-led war in December 2008, January 2009? How about explaining they're murdering 9 Turkish activists in May 2010 aboard the Mavi Marmara Gaza humanitarian mission? How about stories about that? How about the truth instead of big lies? How about blocking out real news with news that either is less important or totally unimportant, and most of all, most often I should say, it isn't a story about a missing aircraft. It's what others have said comprise junk food news, meaningless garbage, or entertainment, or sports, or celebrity features, the kind of crap that deserves no coverage at all. But this is what goes on. But I'm obsessed that the Malaysian story gets this type of obsession in the major media. haven't followed it in the European media, but in American media, you turn on your television set, but the only time I do it to check a newscast is to see what the heck they're featuring. And invariably, it's a story. Then I tune it right out. Why waste your time listening to garbage? Tune in alternative media. I hope many do it to this program because it's so important. I do want to say one thing that I meant to say straight away at the top of the hour. I guess, Denny, we're not connected yet. Hopefully we'll get Denny because we had a follow-up last time, and Denny missed the whole program, and I felt very bad about that, so I rescheduled him. And I mean, it's possible there's something going on at his end. I hope not. And hopefully we'll connect with him okay. But the thing that I want to stress, and I meant to do it at the top of the hour, I'll take a moment to do it now. My former schedule was being on live Fridays at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, Saturdays and Sundays live at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. My new schedule is live Sundays only at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. On two other days, I do it on Thursday and Friday, I am pre-recording programs that will not appear live. They won't be broadcast live. They'll be in my archives, hopefully quickly, after I pre-record them. I began doing this last Thursday and Friday. I haven't checked the archives, but they absolutely should be there now. So listeners can access my archives to get all my programs. And I must say that most of my listeners hear me through the archives rather than live, which makes sense because people are busy. They may be at work during the week. Probably they are. On weekends, they may be involved in family activities. Probably they are. So they can tune into my program at their convenience. And that's the beauty of archives. When I listen to another program, I always go to the archives because I'm spending my entire day writing. I'm doing interviews. I mentioned I had one about an hour or so ago. Another one tomorrow. As a matter of fact, two tomorrow. I was invited earlier to do another interview tomorrow, so I'll have two tomorrow. Almost a day does not go by that somebody doesn't ask me to do an interview. Some are short, some are longer, and I always want to do them because important topics are discussed, and I feel an obligation to do this, both on my own program as a host and on somebody else's as a guest, engaging in marvelous discussion, focusing scrupulously on the truth. I can't imagine doing it any other way. And I know I've said it before, but I'll repeat it again. I'm an unpaid volunteer. Nobody pays me a dime to pick topics, to say what I will say about them. I speak freely. I do it unpaid. I try very hard to get the truth and let other people know what I've learned. I do scrupulous research. I've had a lot of practice. I'm writing daily articles. Two, in fact, three on yesterday. Occasionally I write three in one day. Almost always I write two, and they come out day after day after day. It's pretty easy to do the research if you put your mind to it. Anybody can do what I do. I had to learn. You get better as you go along. You know the old saying about how do you get to Carnegie Hall? Practice, practice, practice. Well, how do you get to be a fairly decent writer? Practice, practice, practice. The writing I do now, I think I did a reasonably good job researching when I started, but I do a much better job now because I've done it so many times. And I know, looking back at my early articles, if I wrote on the same topics today, going back into that time frame, I would write them a little differently than I did then. I think I've improved over time. My God, I should have improved over the years. I began almost 9 years ago doing this in retirement at age 70. It's never too late. It's never too late. I was involved in work like everybody else, family, preoccupied with the things everybody is preoccupied with, just the normal way things are. And when I retired, I had no interest in going fishing or shopping. I did so much traveling in private business that to be able to never have to, but to be able to stay away from airports and hotels was an absolute joy. And I remember saying to myself and to friends, my favorite hotel is inside my front door, and my favorite restaurant is in my kitchen. And I absolutely meant it. And to this day, I mean it. That's the way I felt. You get sick and tired of going to airports, getting on airplanes, delays, bad weather, this, that. I can't imagine why people love travel who have to do it all the time to make a living, and I just did too much of it. At the beginning, it was a big deal. You know, going to places like San Francisco and other major U.S. cities a couple of times overseas. Oh, it was a gas. It was wonderful. Well, at the end, if I had to take a trip, I preferred going to Detroit to San Francisco because an hour flight was a lot better than a four-hour one. That's the way I felt about travel. And as you get older, and I'm certainly not a kid anymore, travel can get very onerous, and I certainly don't do it unless I have to. I do none of it for a vacation. I can't imagine taking a vacation. I would do it related to my work, to my writing. If somebody asked me to give a talk and it was important, I absolutely would go. I've been invited a couple of times, and that's important to do, and I would do it. That's in the line of what I do now. It's my mission. It's my obligation, so it's important to do. But just to take a trip for the fun of it. I've been told by friends, why don't you take a break and go lie on the beach somewhere and just relax? And I said if I did it unconnected, I'd go crazy. And I really mean that. I look forward every day to doing what I'm doing. Still haven't gotten Denny? Still getting voicemail? I just kind of meant I sent him an email. I don't know why he's not responding. If we don't connect to him this time, I'll reschedule him again. We'll do it a third time. But don't understand what the heck is going on. Let's talk about some of the issues that I'm concerned about. I wrote an article yesterday about Turkey being exposed for a planned false flag attack on Turkish territory, maybe more than one pieces of Turkish territory inside Turkey. And Turkey has Turkish territory located inside Syria. And the scheme was to launch a false flag, blame it on the Syrian government, and use it as a pretext to wage war, to cite what's called the NATO alliance's Article 5, which says an attack on one NATO country, 28 of them, is an attack on all of them, and the other 27 countries are obligated to come to the defense of the attack country. Well, there's nothing said about you can't do it if it's a false flag. Well, this was a false flag. The phone conversation between four Turkish officials, including the foreign minister, including a general, including a deputy foreign minister, I believe, and one other man, fairly long conversation. It wasn't that long, but a conversation that probably went on for 15 or 20 minutes, maybe longer. And I think I got all of it. It was all hacked into, I guess, however you do these things. It was all recorded. It's all there. I wrote an article about it. It's top featured on my blog site, Steve Lendman blog. Go there. You'll see the article. You'll see the YouTube. You'll see the full conversation in English. You'll see a link to the YouTube that's in Turkish, so you can tune in. But if you don't speak Turkish, you won't understand it. I didn't tune into it. But I mean, these people are Turks. They're going to speak Turkish. I imagine they spoke Turkish. But here it is, translated in English, and I used the full conversation, and I prefaced it with a statement saying, I think it's important to do this to show you the way rogue states operate and plan their crimes. And you know what this government does? The same thing goes on in Washington, in spades, in Britain, in France, in Germany, in Israel, in all these rogue states, planning vicious attacks against their enemies, innocent people, Palestinians, people who are non-threatening, and yet they're attacked and they're blamed wrongfully. Well, this false flag was exposed. I'll bet you dollars to donuts there'll be another one. Well, Washington tried earlier. Last summer, there was a false flag chemical attack last August in a Damascus suburb called Ghouta, G-H-O-U-T-A. I wrote several times about it. It was exposed as a false flag. Britain, France, and Washington could not agree on exactly what happened. The Keystone cops, they couldn't get their story straight. One said 300 were killed, another said 400, and Washington said 438, something like that. How they would come up with a precise number like that is virtually impossible. But John Kerry did. John Kerry is a serial liar, just the way Obama is a serial liar, and the French and the British authorities are serial liars. Cameron, Haig, the foreign minister, defense minister, forget his name, for Britain, Francois Hollande, president of France, French foreign minister, at least Angela Merkel, they're all in this dirty game together. Well, the dirty scheme in Syria is the same thing that went on in Ukraine. Oust the democratically elected government. Well, Syria, I would not say was a democratically elected government. It certainly will be when the next election is held, because the Assad government is overwhelmingly supported, and it's no surprise. I would say 75. The last poll I saw was over 70%. I'll bet you it's over 80% now. If an election, a legitimate, independently monitored election were held today, I would bet that Assad would get at least 75% of the votes for president, which is the reason Washington does not want a legitimate election. They want him ousted before an election can be held. What they really want is full-scale intervention. You know, proxy war is being committed. Obama just made a courtesy call to Saudi Arabia, one of the most despotic regimes in the world, you know, discussing their plans of belligerence against the Syrian government. Well, there will be more weapons supplied. These Western-supported invaders, most of the insurgents are death squads. They're not Syrians or they're former Syrians. They live outside Syrians. They're imported from dozens of countries, including some from Europe, maybe some from America, but they're mostly in the Middle East, East Asia. That's where they're coming from. So they could be from Afghanistan, from Pakistan, from Jordan, dare I say Saudi Arabia, Qatar. Israel is very much involved in this. Israel wants the Assad government removed. It wants a regional rival replaced with a subservient pro-Western stooge government. That's the deal in Syria. That's the deal in Ukraine. A stooge government replacing a legitimate one, whether it's a good one or a bad one, whether it's a democratic one or another one or anything in between. It's the government. It's for the people to decide who will rule them. It's not for an outside power. And international law, which I quote so often, did readers think I'm a lawyer? Well, I'm not a lawyer, but I can read just the way anybody else can. And international law is very easy to read and understand. And I look it up all the time. All the time. And I quote directly from it. Sometimes I paraphrase. Sometimes I quote verbatim. And it's very clear. Intervening, meddling in the internal affairs of another country is absolutely forbidden, with no exceptions, except in self-defense, if attacked, or if an attack is so imminent that self-defense is required. But the bottom line is, even if a country responds this way, the sole final authority is the UN Security Council. And unless it says okay, another country cannot go to war, cannot attack another country. Congress has no say. Well, America can't attack another country unless Congress does okay it. But Congress is a secondary authority. The Security Council is the sole authority. It's right in the UN Charter. It's in black and white. Anybody can look it up. Anybody can read it. And America, of course, is a signatory to the UN Charter, which means it's obligated to observe international law and all other international laws it's a signatory to. Does it do it? No. Has it ever done it? No. Does it violate these wars every time? Yes. Does it do it unaccountably? Yes. Does it do it with impunity? Yes. Do millions of corpses attest to Americans' brutality? Yes, in spades. And not just post 9/11. From the beginning of the Republic, from George Washington, who considered Native Americans wolves, quote unquote, to be exterminated. George Washington. And I remember in one of the earliest articles I ever wrote, I said something to the effect that with a father like that, what would you expect from his offspring? George Washington! My God! This is the way he operated? Well, don't forget he was a general before he became president. A general! and his job was exterminating American Native Americans. So what the hell do you expect from George Bush and Obama? They want to exterminate everybody who gets in their way. And this is the situation that's ongoing. So multiple wars are being waged. Legitimate governments are being overthrown. Syria, before Syria, Iraq, Libya, Afghanistan. You don't hear about the other proxy wars. How about Obama's war on Lebanon? Well, there is a little bit of a war going on in Lebanon because the Syrian war spills over. Certainly Obama's war on Syria. That absolutely is Obama's war. It was planned during the 1990s before he became president. He picked up the baton, and he's waging it. It's not Assad's war. The Syrian people love Assad because he's their only defense against these death squads that are murdering people, committing atrocities. And I have an article that I'm working on. I'll get out tomorrow related to the Syrian war. I'm still working on it, so it's not done. But it'll be on my blog site tomorrow. The big one for me yesterday, I did three articles yesterday. One was on the Turkish false flag. Another one was on a UN commission denouncing America's human rights record. There are nine, I didn't know this, I looked it up and I discovered there are nine UN human rights bodies. There's a human rights council that's in the tank for the power structure. That's in my article for tomorrow on Syria. They blame the Syrian government for the crimes these insurgents have committed. That's the way they operate. But the Human Rights Commission operates by different standards. Now, if you can imagine a UN body that I consider a wholly owned subsidiary of Washington, has the, chutzpah to come out with a legitimate report, chapter and verse, denouncing America's human rights abuses. It's in my article. It's on my blog site. Anybody can go there and look it up and read it in black and white. Important stuff in that, in their report. Real important stuff. The kind of stuff that I would write about. And it's right there. Did it get any coverage in the scoundrel media? I didn't see it. I didn't hear it. Nothing. Nothing. Did you hear anything about the Turkish false flag when you turned on Fox News or CNN? Nothing. If the New York Times covers this stuff sometimes, they'll do it in a fairly long article, bury it in paragraph 20. Most readers never get past paragraph 3. That's why they bury it in paragraph 20, and they give it short shrift. That's the way the New York Times operates, with inflammatory headlines. Some of them are bad. Some of them sound like Fox News. We're getting close to a break. We can take it any time. When I hear the music strike up the band, I'll take a break, and then I'll come back and continue. I don't like being my own guest, but I can do it if I have to. There's plenty to talk about, but I feel bad that I'm not connecting with Denny, and I have no idea why. And I sent him an email. I'm going to send him another one while we take a short break. Let's take the break now. Welcome back. Steve Lenman here. Still trying to get Denny. During the break, I got off this line, and I dialed his line, and he's in Canada. He's bilingual, French and English, maybe more than two languages, and he left a message in French. I pretty much understood what he was saying, even though I don't speak French. I know a little bit, but not a lot. And I left him a message to please try to get on for as much of the rest of the program as possible. I felt bad that I didn't connect with Denny last time. But again, I repeat, I will reschedule him, so I'll get him on as soon as I can. Possibly something happened. I mean, it could be illness. It could be a family emergency. It could be anything. So this is important to me, and I do want to help him any way I can. But again, so much of what I'm doing, the things that I focus on that we discuss in this program, I can pick it up and continue the program. I talked about the Turkish false flag, the UN Commission denouncing U.S. human rights abuses. Tomorrow, I've got one article in progress for tomorrow. So I don't like to talk about something I'm still working on. Possibly in the editing I'll make some changes. But I have another article. I do an awful lot debunking anti-Russian propaganda, vicious propaganda. I remember the entirety of the Cold War. I remember World War II, mostly the end of it, the last couple of years, when I was old enough to understand what was going on, enough to understand. But I remember all of the Cold War. No television in the early days. No television in my household until I was, I believe, a junior in high school. And news in those days, it wasn't particularly good, but the only news, television news, was something like 15 minutes a day with only three television channels. Then a little bit later on, a public television. That's what passed for television in those days, in the early days. They came around, in the late 1940s. I remember watching General Douglas MacArthur give his Old Soldiers Never Die speech. I watched that live on television. I watched the McCarthy hearings live on television. History, didn't know it at the time, but looking back, big stuff. That stuff was worth watching, you know, because it's history, not because it was any good. I certainly wasn't a MacArthur supporter. And McCarthy, I've written a few times about Joe McCarthy, nicknamed Tail Gunner Joe, the war hero who wasn't a war hero. You know, the commie hunter who never once exposed a communist. He never found a single one. With all the harm he did to so many people, he never found a single communist. He never found anybody intending to do any harm to this country. But, of course, that's not the way he was portrayed. And like other rogues, he brought himself down. He brought himself down. But I don't want to talk about Joe McCarthy. There are plenty around like him today that do far more mischief. The dirty stuff continues, and we see it all the time, whether it's nefarious stuff going on internally in America, whether it's imperial wars being waged. I mentioned before the break some of the proxy ones. How many listeners know that U.S. Special Forces, and the definition of a Special Forces is an expert in killing. These people are trained killers. They operate in over 120 countries worldwide. The UN has 193. There are two observer countries, the Vatican and Palestine. That's 195. There are a couple that should be recognized countries, but are not, because of U.S. pressure, of course. Legitimate countries, well, Crimea now. Well, Crimea is part of Russia. Crimea is not a separate country, and Russia is certainly recognized. But America doesn't recognize Crimea. Well, who gives a damn what America recognizes? What is. What's legal is legal. It's legitimate. It exists. Move on. Crimeans are certainly delighted about it. To the tune of 96.77% of the voting population with an 82% turnout on a legitimate referendum, the kind that never happens in America, a legitimate democratic referendum, what real democracy looks like, independently monitored from, I remember the number, I think it was 143, from a good many countries, including some Western ones. Nary a comment that the referendum wasn't totally open, free, and fair. And even non-Russian-speaking Crimeans came out in big numbers and supported reunification with Russia. The Ukrainian population, the Tatar population, and 18,000 Ukrainian military forces stationed in Crimea, 16,000 of them thereabouts, rejected the Kiev putschists, did not want to go home. They're staying in Crimea. They'll be integrated into Russia's military. And Vladimir Putin explained that their pay and benefits will be raised to be the same as Russian military forces, which he estimates are roughly four times the compensation Ukrainian military forces are paid. I don't know why anybody would have wanted to go home. 2,000 decided they wanted to go home. They've either gone and left, or they plan to, you know, packing up and getting out. You can't just pick up and go like that. It takes a little bit of time. Been a long time since I moved. It's a pain in the you-know-what. But 2,000 are going home. 16,000 are staying. They want nothing to do with these criminals that pose as a government in Kiev. Thugs, fascists, neo-Nazis. I mean, these are really bad actors. Two of them are political parties. One wasn't when the stuff began last November. It's declared itself a political party. This is the right sector. These are the most extremist neo-Nazis. Another one called the Svoboda Party neo-Nazis also. Almost as bad, maybe a smidgen less bad, but you know you're splitting hairs when you cut it that way. Neo-Nazis, enough said, explains who they are. And these people, right sector and Svoboda, hold powerful portfolios in the so-called interim government. There'll be an election, a sham election, on the 25th of May, presidential election, not a legitimate Democrat running, none, zero. The favorite candidate is a billionaire, I don't know whether to call him a chocolate king. He's in the chocolate business. He has other businesses. Don't have his name in front of me. You got to have these names in front of you to pronounce them right and remember them, not like Smith and Jones. But this guy is the leading candidate. In one of my articles for tomorrow, I mention a poll mid-March, 36.8% approval. The other main candidates are this mega crook, Yulia Tymoshenko, stole hundreds of millions of dollars, was rightfully imprisoned. The putschists freed her illegitimately. She's a crook. I mean, she's like the types on Wall Street. Hundreds of millions of dollars she stole. And now she's free. She's a presidential candidate. The poll showed her with about 12% approval. The retired heavyweight boxing champion, Glitchko, he was a candidate, and he dropped out. And he gave his support to the Chocolate King. I'm sure he was bribed to do it. You know, he'll get a lush job paying a big bucks for supporting the Chocolate King, plus all the chocolate he can eat, of course. And other there are other candidates where they can come and they can go, but I think 12%, there was another candidate with 10% approval, and everybody below that had single digit or virtually nothing. But the candidates are very fluid. The Wikipedia page I looked at had something like 8 designated candidates and a number of others who hadn't officially submitted their bids to be candidates. And the Chocolate King was one of those people. But he's getting his in. My God, if he's the leading candidate and if he wants to be president, you know, an oligarch. So what do you want, a neo-Nazi running things or an oligarch connected to neo-Nazis running things? And this is what will pass for the government of Ukraine after this so-called election. Democracy, some democracy, and the IMF has stepped in. They've offered a $14 to $18 billion loan. Gerald Celente is right, calling the IMF the loan shark of last resort. That's what it is, the loan shark of last resort. They make neighborhood loan sharks look benign by comparison. You get in these people, you get in bed with these people, and boy, you are really stuck. Because none of the money, well, the money that is supposedly loaned, this $14 to $18 billion, where does it go? Most of it goes to pay bankers first. Enough of it goes to pay bureaucrats. A decent wage? Sub-poverty wages. Just enough to keep the trains running. Doesn't matter if they're on time. Just keep them running. Keep the buses going. Keep the basic stuff going. Badly, but keep it going. So you need a few bucks to pay the bureaucrats. So crumbs will go to pay them. Fuel prices, by May 1st, you know, people needed to drive their cars to heat their homes, going up 40%. And the Naftogaz, I believe that's the name of the gas company in Ukraine, said before too long they'll go up another 40%. I think they're really heading for being doubled. I saw an article that I have to take a closer look at that said they'll be doubled. But the initial hike would be 40%. 40%? The Ukrainian people already, before this coup, were very, very much impoverished. And now they are being hammered by an IMF loan. An IMF loan makes usury look good by comparison. It mandates privatizing Ukraine's crown jewel enterprises. It means mass layoffs. It means cut or frozen wages. It means eroding en route to entirely eliminating social benefits. It's making impoverished people literally on their own sink or swim. You can't buy food, so starve. You can't get medical care, so die. That's what IMF medicine is all about. And the Ukrainian government, the Putschist government, the illegal government, agreed to do this. Why? Because they were bribed to do it. Why else? They sold out their country for big bucks. They can line their pockets, whatever they ask for, $1 million, $5 million, whatever they wanted. Ask and they get. Cheap to sell out their country to IMF criminals so they can rape and pillage the country, so they can deeply impoverish the already impoverished Ukrainian people. Wait till they find out the full brunt of what's being done to them. Maybe there'll be a real revolution. Maybe they'll think the former government, Viktor Yanukovych, his government, that was corrupt, but it will look saintly compared to what's going on now. And they will find out. They're already beginning to find out. Pensions for impoverished old ladies and men were cut in half. And they only got $160 before. Down to $80 a month. $80 a month. And oh, by the way, fuel prices, as I said, are skyrocketing. They were rising before. Now they'll really rise. Food prices, skyrocketing. You know, maybe you can get away with not driving your car. Maybe you can wear a heavy coat in winter and keep from freezing to death. I don't know. I've never tried it. You certainly can't survive without food. But kiss away medical care. Kiss away food if you can't afford high prices. Kiss away education for your kids. Kiss away everything free people should have access to in legitimate democratic societies. It's all going, gone. To be sure, bankers are paid first and other big investors. And that's the dirty business going on in Ukraine, plus harsh crackdowns on what I call non-believers. Anybody who's so upset because they're starving, they can't put food on the table for their kids, the fascists will go out in the street, bludgeon them, shoot them, murder them, silence them. That's the dirty business going on in Ukraine. Do you hear anything about this? You hear nothing about it in the major media. Obama calls these people Democrats. Denny is on. Denny, welcome.
Oh, yes. Thanks.
What happened?
I'm so sorry to be late. There's a snowstorm here in Ottawa, and I went out with family. And anyway, I'm really sorry about that.
Let's cover as much ground as you can, discussing the latest on your issue. And we only have, a scant 10 minutes. Go ahead,
yes.
Denny.
You'd like to hear the latest, right?
Yes.
Well, as you know, I was dismissed at the University of Ottawa.
Yes.
Unjustly, and so on. That was back in 2009. It took 4 years to go to arbitration, so to go before a labor arbitration board with a single arbitrator, and there was what I believe is a very unjust decision. The union and I thought that from a legal standpoint we were pretty certain we had won, but the arbitrator ruled against me and upheld the dismissal. So now my union and the Canadian Association of University Teachers are of the opinion that that was unjust and that we must fight it all the way because it is such a bad decision for academic freedom in Canada. So now we are doing what is called a judicial review, so that decision will go before a panel of three judges. And hopefully they will have the wisdom to recognize the fatal errors in law that were made by the arbitrator. And so it's an ongoing saga, unfortunately. It's taken so long, but it's something that I felt, well, I feel that there's already been a lot of justice through the process, because through the arbitration itself, it has exposed in detail what the university has done and how it has done it, the fact that it had hired a student spy following me around on other campuses, all my activities, including in off hours and so on, and sending weekly reports to the university about everything that I did in the hope of finding something they could use against me. And then, just all kinds of things like that, trespassing me from campus while I was still a tenured and full professor, having me taken away by police in handcuffs, all these horrible things that they did, all came out in great detail during the arbitration. So it was good for the public to see that, and the arbitration was well attended, and it was reported in the media, and it was reported fairly. So we got, the public got to know how the institution was behaving in this case. And so already there's been a large measure of justice, but the arbitration decision, unfortunately, I don't want to speculate about how it went so wrong, but it did, and so now we're trying to appeal it. That's the latest on that front. Yep.
And it's an uphill battle, Denny. You're literally, it's like fighting City Hall. But everything that you've detailed just now and on previous programs proves to me what I say so often about America, that Canada, like America, is a police state. If this is the way it treats the best in its society, and Denny, you certainly are one of Canada's best. There's no question about that. And they treat you disgracefully, and the same kind of stuff goes on in America, where literally people they should build monuments to. They brutalize them. They wrongfully persecute them, and sometimes they put them in prison.
I don't think anyone can deny that I was speaking the truth as I see it, that I was really speaking my mind, and I was being very upfront, criticizing the university, my employer, and being very critical of the administration and of how they were managing public money and of the things they were doing behind closed doors, which I would find out by doing access to information requests and so on, and then making that all public on my blog, the U of O Watch blog. And so they were very upset with me, but I was just saying what I thought needed to be said. And they were mistreating students as well, and so I would speak up for the students, and I would defend the students, and I would describe what they were doing to students on my blog. And my sense is they really did not appreciate my being that vocal, and they decided to target me and to take me out, and they did. I mean, one day to the next, all of a sudden I was locked out of my laboratory. And it's true, I mean, from a scientific point of view, I still am very highly regarded. And at the time, one of Canada's leading scientists wrote a letter of support of me and said that I myself was a world leading scientist, and that I was one of the very top people in my field, which was also his field, one of the very top people in the world. But it didn't make any difference. They didn't care about it. They didn't care about the research funding that I brought in. They didn't care that I was supervising close to a dozen graduate students and a postdoctoral fellow and so on, that I had brought in some of the largest research funds in the Faculty of Science. None of that mattered. They just decided we're going to find a pretext and take this man out. And it's got to be done quickly. And they just moved ahead. They bulldozed it through. And then during the arbitration, it was very sad to see how they argued the case, because they were just pulling out all kinds of absurd things. They were making claims, which happily were ridiculed in the media, but making claims like that I was inciting students to violence and this kind of stuff. Just outrageous things. You could see how they were behaving, and you could see the lengths they would go to, you know, to take me out, because they didn't appreciate what I was doing. Inviting Palestinian speakers into my classroom to talk about what they lived in Palestine and in Gaza in particular, and all these kinds of things, being accused in the media at the time of not being balanced in my approach. My classes were the opposite of imbalance. I mean, we got to hear all the points of views, including the things that are never heard, that students never get to hear throughout most of their studies. So that's what's happened to me, and it's continuing on, and so we're pushing forward, and I've said this before on your show, but these legal battles are causing me to have quite a lot of expenses if I want to push them through. I'm not paying any lawyers in the things where I'm self-represented, but I could use the helping hand with regards to filing fees and things like that, so people can find my blogs and hit the PayPal button. That would be great. You can go to uofowatch.blogspot.com, or you can go to activistteacher.blogspot.com, and you'll find me easily, or you can just Google my name, and people will find me right away.
Well, Denny, I encourage listeners to do that, and I mentioned it earlier in the program before I got you on, that, I mean, you're fighting a noble battle, and you certainly deserve all the support that you can get. Absolutely, and you really put up an incredible struggle for justice, and it's long-term. It doesn't go away in a hurry, and you're going up against very powerful people who simply don't take no for an answer, and even when you're 100% right, and they're 100% wrong. Oh, my God, the battle continues. We've got we've got less than a minute left, Denny. A few final comments from you.
Well, I have a court deadline of Monday to file documents, and I was so involved with that. And then I'm really sorry that I missed the beginning of your show. I was hoping to be there from the very beginning. But we'll catch up next time.
We'll catch up. I'll get you rescheduled as soon as I can. I'm booked a little bit ahead, but I'll get back to you. I'll suggest another date to get you on for the full hour, Denny, because I very much want to do that. Your story is important. Your story highlights what happens to so many other people. If you were a lone example, it would be bad enough to do this to anybody, distinguished or otherwise, but this happens to so many people in Canada, in America, and other Western countries alone, let alone truly despotic ones, that this is the kind of story that needs to be highlighted to show that America and Canada are no democracies. They're police states. Anybody
thinking
who does
independently
stuff like this,
and something that is not their ideological line is incredibly dangerous. They will
absolutely.
They will take you down.
And if they want to get you, they can find a way to get you.
Oh yeah,
no,
they have the power to do it. Yes.
They really do. Denny, I've got to sign off. My time is just about up. I'll do that. And I'll just remind listeners, again, two archive programs that can be accessed easily on the PRN site, always on Sunday live at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.
Thanks, Stephen.